Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The big story is Michelle's blunder. In other words, she goes to Spain while people here, you got a double dip inflation, it's at 10%. And you got people behind in their mortgages, and she says she's just like you. And now she's flying around, going to Spain. The question is, why didn't she go to San Diego if she likes beaches so much and ice cream? I mean, she can get an ice cream cone in Chicago, number one. I love how she lectures on diet and exercise and vegetable gardens and rolling sweet potato gardens. And every time I look, she's eating an ice cream cone. What kind of message is that? It's the same message as I just said. Do as I say, not as I do. But the point is really bigger than that. Here we have a nation in fiscal crisis with an out-of-control government that has no idea about fiscal constraint, and their own party has abandoned their insanity. For example, one of the Council of Economic Advisors, a fairly moderate woman, I am told, by comparison to what's going on around her, has left. She's gone back to her teaching job at the University of California at Berkeley, Christine Romer, and so now it's going to be turned over to the radicals, the complete left-wing lunatics, who have never managed a hot dog stand, let alone offered a service to anyone that anyone's ever needed. And so what they're going to do is obvious. With the insane Nancy Pelosi, Big Chin Pelosi there, she's going to write more checks for more people, more public works projects, and she's going to further indebt America to the point where we'll become nothing but a fax republic. Not a banana republic, because we don't grow bananas here. I think all we produce are faxes and emails. That's about the only product left in America since Bill Clinton exported our factories to China 15 years ago. All we have left are fax machines amongst those who don't have email and a postal service that should be closed down. Yeah, I thought about the high carbon postal truck came up my block at 5 o'clock to deliver the mail. Crack, you know, like just like the Pony Express. There was the driver that got his first job picking his nose in the truck. And he comes every day at 5 o'clock, just when I needed the mail at the end of a work day. And the fumes from the postal truck come into the window of the house. And I ask myself, why does a government that can't even run a postal service right, after all these years, think they can run a healthcare department correctly? The answer is they don't care. Of course they can't run a healthcare any more efficiently than it's been run. Of course they're going to wreck the economy even further. But why should it matter to Michelle Obama when she has Air Force Two? You know what I'm saying? So in light of that fact, it's kind of a crazy situation for all of us. And that's why I say we have to focus on the economics of the situation more than anything else. Let's bake it down to a brass tacks. It's time to admit that Obamanomics has failed America. Everybody is saying that, even stupid liberals who voted for the president. The economy is stalling. Unemployment is stuck at European levels of idleness, 10%. The federal deficit and the national debt are at historic highs. The public's confidence in Congress is at its lowest ever level. Big majority of mainstream Americans say Obama has the country on the wrong path. Obamanomics is a miserable failure, and everybody has admitted it except Obama and his minions. Isn't it time for you to admit it? Even Christina Rome, a chairwoman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, retired. 131,000 jobs lost in July. Downward revisions of 97,000 for the previous 2 months. So she's looking for the exits, of course. Now, what's going to happen is that there's going to be more money for stimulus, meaning Nancy Pelosi has to reward her friends who don't even know what to do with the money that's already falling out of their Swiss bank accounts. $308 million in subsidies to BP before the Gulf oil disaster. Subsidizing a study on what happens when monkeys snort cocaine. This is the government under psychopathic college liberals. That's why I say the pain from Spain falls mainly down the drain. Now, I'm all over the map today, which is beautiful, because that's the way it has to be for you. You have a low attention span, and this is not public broadcasting where we work on the public's dime. I have to maintain your attention. They don't. Now, over the weekend, in addition to finding new rock and roll songs for you, could you play Lonely Boy by Paul Anka, by the way? Play Lonely Boy on the Paul Anka Show.
I'm just a lonely boy.
Boo-hoo.
Lonely and blue. I'm all alone.
Remember this?
With nothing to do. I've got everything.
All right, it doesn't have any verb anyway. Break that record. I could say The Lonely Boy, The Crybaby, that's not going to work anymore. Michelle making a mockery of the presidency. Other than that, Bill Gates, I saw him on C-SPAN arguing for death panels, and I almost fell out of my chair. I said, wait a minute. Don't you remember last spring I don't know what season we're in already. It's summer, right? In the spring, whenever they were trying to push Obamacare, we so-called right-wingers, who are really the rationalists of today. We're actually the rationalists of today. The rationalists try to warn you that the health care bill would contain death panels. And the propaganda ministry put out the big report. No, there are no death panels. That's right-wing paranoia. It's been proven not to be true. Well, it turns out that, in fact, Rahm Emanuel's brother, whatever his name is, Ezekiel Emanuel. I think he has another brother named Jeremiah, but he hasn't yet appeared from the old country. But Ezekiel Emanuel, a doctor himself, in fact argued for such death panels in a position paper he had written a number of years ago. And we were told he was one of the individuals who was deeply involved in drafting Obamacare. Well, now I hear Microsoft CEO Bill Gates putting on the oh gosh begosh nice guy, cardigan sweater act, calling for death panels. We have that sound for you. But the fact is, I do speak for many of you who are in trouble, and no one speaks for you. And the newspapers are all propaganda rags, and they won't tell you what's true. By and large, they try to bury anything that makes Obama look like what he is. It's an embarrassment. Michelle Obama is an embarrassment for the presidency right now. And some are noting it. Mainly in Europe, they're noticing it. One woman writer for the Post called her the Marie Antoinette of the day. I would call her the Madame Defarge of the day. She got it almost right. She's not Marie Antoinette. I mean, she's more like Madame Defarge. She just hasn't yet. She's keeping the books yet. She hasn't yet opened up the camps. Let's go to the callers for a moment. Chicago, Betsy, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Michael. Listen, I'm a big fan. I don't have to say that. But, you know, I really think you're mischaracterizing Elena Kagan. She was... That question to her about Christmas was really, she was put off guard on that. And what the senator...
Oh, well, hold on. She was put off guard for the first time, and she answered and showed her true nature, which is not up to the dignified standards of the Supreme Court. She could have shown her true nature by saying, I generally celebrate Christmas with Christian friends, although I am not Christian myself.
Well, you're demeaning Jews, not Elena Kagan, and you're putting everything to fit your mold to demonize her.
There we go again. Anyone who criticizes any Jew is a Jew hater, right? Is that it?
No, you demean Jews.
Well, you heard me hold up Louis Brandeis. Why don't you congratulate me for that? You don't even know who Louis Brandeis is, do you? You're an expert on everything. But do you know who Louis Brandeis is until I told you today?
Goes about Brandeis. Would you like me to send him to you? I know all about Brandeis.
Also, you're an expert on Louis Brandeis, but you didn't say, Michael, thanks for telling America about the Jewish Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. How come that didn't come out of your mouth?
I know about him.
Oh, you know about him, but my audience may not have known about him. I was trying to show the difference between a gutter rat like Kagan and a distinguished man like Brandeis.
And this is why you always get in trouble, because you shoot yourself in the foot. You lose people this way, Michael. You have so many people that love you, but your mind is so closed.
Oh, my mind is closed and your mind is open?
Michael, I think your mind
is... Hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. Tell me what it is about a Kagan that makes her distinguished. Go ahead.
Did you listen to everything today like a lot of...
I ask you... No, don't play a Talmudic scholar with me. You tell me, since you're defending her, what she has said or done as a legal scholar that gives you hope that she will bring to the Supreme Court the kind of balance we need. What happened to your tongue? Oh, where'd you go, lady? Oh, honey. Look, honey, that's why you're alone at this age. That's why your husband left you. That's why your children don't see you except on Christmas, honey. Because when you finally get a real question, suddenly you hang up. But let me tell you something. She has no distinguished history. And I am not distorting her. She is a distortion of reality, this woman. And she gave herself away with the Chinese restaurant joke. And that is why I'm hammering it. I found a way to get into your psyches about Kagan and the actual level of this woman.
Savage.
You know, I thought about dogs last night. I got to tell you this. I'm not going to go in, my dog is great, but my dog is great. This 10-pound poodle, Teddy. I was mad at him for 2 days. I gave him the cold shoulder in the house, little hidden areas there. But I forgave him. Now we're friends again. Now every morning I get up, it's the same thing. He sits on this pink chair. I have a recliner that I bought. I don't know how they let this store into Marin County. All the libs were like mad at it. Lazy Boy. When Lazy Boy opened him in Marin County, all the phony snobs, ooh, we can't have that in our county. It's not classy. I went and I bought a beautiful recliner that is so ugly, it's unbelievable. It's like ugly chair. Every house must have an ugly chair. That's the only chair you actually wind up sitting in. Beautiful chairs nobody will sit in. If they do, you have to worry that you're going to stain it, you know, with something. But the ugly chair you could sit in, you can eat in it, you can drink in it, coffee could spill on it, doesn't matter. This chair is so comfortable that Teddy took it over. It's his chair. So every morning, it's a pink recliner from Lazy Boy. He jumps on the chair, and he puts his back up against it, and he gives me his two paws out, I swear to God, and he does it. I taught him how to do high five. Give me five. And we do like we play. Like I do the hands back and forth. Give me five. Give me four. Give me three. He loves this game. He could have been a circus dog. My dog could have been anything. I wonder how he is. He had a little growth underneath his private part that was worrying me a little bit. He went to the vet today. I don't even know how it came out. You know, maybe we should get the vet on the show, see how Teddy's private parts are, because I want to breed him this year. I don't want him to disappear. How? You know, once in a few hundred thousand years, a perfect animal comes along. How could his genes be lost? He's like Western civilization himself, my dog. We got to breed this dog. I got to have five or six puppies and keep two of them. I'm not going to sell him. You think I'm going to sell him and have a liberal buy him? Oh, yeah, I want. And they're going to send me pictures of him being mauled in a pit bull arena to torture me? No. I would never sell puppies. No, I couldn't do it, you know, because I don't know how they'll be used. I'll keep a couple of them. So I'm becoming like dog, more and more doggy. I mean, I love the dogs. I just love them so much. Because you can trust them. I thought about it last night, his eyes. Now that he like he knows I like him again after the peeing thing where I gave him the cold shoulder. Dogs' eyes are very interesting. If you don't abuse your dog, you only get a couple of emotions out of them, but none of them are hate. Did you realize what I just said to you? Most dogs don't know how to hate. Yeah, you could train a dog to hate. I'm not talking about that. In general, in a normal house, a dog has a set of emotions that you could see in their eyes. Admiration, love, happiness. Maybe it's sometimes a little hurt when you leave them and you're going to go out and be a human without them. They don't understand it because they think that they're you. Why can't you take me to that wedding tonight, Dad? What is wrong with you? I'm as good as you. I know, son, but not everybody sees the world the way you do. Not everybody wants short, furry creatures running around at weddings or in restaurants. You'll have to just stay home. So you get those, but you never get hate. Does dog ever look at you with hatred? No, which is why we love them. You understand that? Well, you should have a dog. And by the way, don't trust people who don't have dogs. Oh, I just got the news. The tiny lump under his testicles turns out to be benign. There's nothing there. So, I mean, it was pretty worrisome because there's a little tiny lump there. And like any living creature, you know, or the way of all flesh, you worry. You know, maybe the little guy has cancer or something. But it turns out he's probably bitten by some bug and it scabbed over and it disappeared. But he sure enjoyed licking himself down there all the months that he thought of. He had a justification. Look, who can blame him, you know? I think the reason we're not... the reason we're not dogs, or one of the reasons that they are dogs, is they can do that, however you look at it. I mean, normal men can't do that. That's why we're not dogs. If we were double jointed like that, we probably would be dogs. So God made it so you can't do that. Do you understand what I'm saying? you have an animal, it's amazing to watch how they behave. Even a little thing like a bite in their private parts, what they do with I'm just elated. I'm not felinophobic. Don't get me wrong. I'm not exactly a felinophile. But I prefer dogs because dogs to me are covert and cats dogs are overt and cats are covert. Cats remind me of people in Pacific Heights or in the San Francisco government. Everything they do is hidden and secretive. It's like choir gate. They're trying to sweep it into the cat litter box, but I kind of doubt that that's where it's going to end up. You know, they're like cats in this city, like cats that are really dirty, that gussy themselves up with Da Vinci dresses. But behind it, you know that there's dirty underwear. That's what the whole city reminds me of. The miners came in 49 and 51, the whores. You ever hear that? Mark Twain wrote it. I'm sure many of you love it. I didn't write it. Mark Twain did before the Fairness Doctrine. That's not a dirty word. In 49, the miners came in 51, the whores. And then he says, and then something evolved from it. It's called Pacific Heights. That's how they run San Francisco. But they put on dresses from back east. You know, we have one of the best Opry's west of the Hudson and the Mississippi River. We put on quite a symphony out here. Oh, it's so out of town that I love it. There's no bigger small town than San Francisco. I wouldn't mind if they were patriotic or Americana. But my God, how could they be so anti-American? It's hard to believe. Everything that's family-oriented, they despise. They spit on the flag, the Boy Scouts. But thank God Teddy's okay, that's all. I can't wait to see the little guy after the show. Go home, talk to him. Say, Teddy, I am so glad you went to the doctor and you don't have a tumor under your private parts, but stop licking them already. There's no excuse anymore. You can't say, Dad, it itches, or Dad, there's a problem. You're just being a dirtbag if you keep doing it, Ted. I can't do that because I'll give them a complex. I think you can give dogs a complex. They are very sensitive to criticism. Oh, my God. They're like liberals. Liberals are very good at pretending they don't care what you say to them, but boy, do they care. Whoa, they're thin-skinned.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Years ago, not too many years ago, copyright 2005, God, it's 5 years ago, I wrote Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. Almost everything you hear coming out from the right-wing media is in this book. Almost everything I wrote is being repeated today as though they discovered it themselves. And I don't want to repeat it to prove it because I really don't have to prove anything. The point I'm making is I see things ahead of others. And I am telling you that what I wrote in this book about Bush and the Iraq War, where I said, I hope I am wrong, turned out to be true. Did you hear that? I said that it could turn out that Bush's invasion of Iraq could result in the increase in power of Iran, the increase in the borders of Iran, which has de facto occurred, in the sense, I don't know how many of you understand this, Saddam was a Sunni Muslim. They were a minority group in Iraq, and they kept the majority Shia under control with vicious tactics, okay? Iran is primarily a Shiite nation. Saddam was an enemy of Iran. They had gone to war with each other, killing a million of their own people over God knows what they disagreed with. It was something to do with some religious disbelief about the 1300s, I suspect. But the point is that he was a stabilizing influence in the Middle East, not destabilizing. I don't think you understand that. Saddam was actually a stabilizing influence in the Middle East. He kept Iran in check. Now, I said, God forbid, it could turn out that this is the greatest military blunder in history. Iran will benefit. There will be a new Persia. Now, you're telling me I was wrong about that? You're telling me that my insights and my fears were wrong? I don't think I was wrong. So now I bring it up to the current issues of the day. The current issue of the day is Afghanistan. Nobody can tell me why we are in Afghanistan. Nobody can tell me why so many brave men are being whacked in Afghanistan. So many men are being killed in Afghanistan. For what? Where is the national security imperative? Because I don't understand it. To this minute, I don't have a reason for us being there. Most of the troops who come home don't know why they were there. They're professionals, so they do what they're told. I understand and I respect that. But why are we there? Why are we wasting our national treasuries like this? Why are the people putting up with a liar like Barack Hussein Obama? The biggest liar in American history, the biggest liar in the White House is Barack Hussein Obama. Here is a man who fraudulently claimed he would end the war. Here is a man who committed so many frauds while running for office that he should be impeached. Here is a fraud called Obama who pretends with one hand to be a man for the poor when he caters to the rich because they put him in power. Here is a fraud as a president who said he would end the war in Afghanistan and bring the troops home. Instead, he put 40,000 more troops into Afghanistan, and not a peep comes out of the liberals who put him in power. Hardly a peep. Now let's move on. A hailstorm hit the Bay Area. I've been here since 1975. I've never seen a hailstorm in San Francisco in my life. Now, I'm up on the 20th floor of my apartment, and a hailstorm hits. I hadn't seen one since I was in Rome in 1965 or 4. Hail, huge hail. Boy, I couldn't believe it. Raining down on the building, hitting the deck. So every primitive instinct in me said, God is talking to me personally. That's how I saw it. And I said to my assistant, I said, my life has just changed for the better just now. And he said, what do you mean? I said, the hail. I'm telling you, God is talking to me. Now he said, what are you, crazy? It didn't hail for you, Savage. I know it didn't hail just for me, but I felt in my heart and in my soul on the deepest levels that something deep and profound had changed in my life for the better. And I don't know what it is, but I knew what had happened. Listen to this. This is an amazing story for me. I went out on my boat. Now, I didn't understand what was going on because there were no boats on the bay. It was a sunny day, and I knew it was going to rain. Unhitch the boat, untie the lines, chug-chug, out on the bay. I go out toward the Golden Gate Bridge, and I notice some swells. Hey, it's nice. Feels good. The boat's riding the water really nice. I get under the Golden Gate Bridge. I get into a sea like I've never been in my life. Now, you got to understand something. I'm not the world's best boater, but I've been on boats since 1969. I owned a sailboat without an engine in Hawaii. Again, not a great sailor, but I know water and I know boats. It's a dimension that I feel intuitively. I go out on the bay, and all of a sudden, I'm over my head. I got 8 to 10-foot swells coming at me, and this is a new boat. I have less than 80 hours on it. And all of a sudden, I'm in 8 to 10-foot seas, and they're coming fast. Wham, wham, wham. And all of a sudden, I realize that one wrong move, and I'm going to get broached. And I didn't quite know exactly what to do. There was no guidebook. There was no person to consult. It had to be on pure intuition. Watch where I'm going with the story. I had to ride the seas in a certain way. I knew that if I kept going into the seas, I'd be safer than if I turned wrongly and the sea hits the side of the boat, you're going to get broached, right? So I said to myself, I better keep going at the rough sea that's coming at me. It's like life itself. Sometimes it's safer to go at a sea coming at you, no matter how rough it is, than it is to turn on the sea because it'll turn you over. So I said, for me to figure this out, I got to keep going at the sea. So the waves are smashing at me, and I'm going further and further out toward the Farallons, and I didn't like where I was going. There were no boats out there. And all of a sudden, I pull in my trim tabs, and I do a quick U-turn as fast as I can at high speed, and I get the water behind me. Now I got a mountain of water following me in, but luckily I pulled my trim tabs in, and I rode with a wall of water chasing me back under the Golden Gate Bridge, but it didn't quite break on me because I was riding the crest of a wave on top of the wake of the boat, which was a phenomenal experience. So all I can say is God bless American engines and God bless deep-keeled boats with very, very heavy bottoms because if I had been in a Carver or a Bayliner, I would have been broached and dead. Play Victory at Sea. I know that. Pure intuition. Pure intuition, like life itself. It was a time very much like this time. There were troops abroad. There was peace at home. There was dancing. There was singing. There was a presidential election. Life was going forward as it had for many, many a decade. This is a great story since I'm a dog lover. And I once had a border collie, which was an amazing dog, Bandit. I don't want to tell you what happened to it because I don't know. I remember I moved to Long Island, and he had been a California dog who used to run freely over the valleys. He'd escape every yard Bandit was ever in. The kids loved him. This dog was so wonderful, Bandit. And no matter what we put him in, he could jump the gate. And he always used to run across the valley and meet up with a girl dog. He was so smart, he would free her from her backyard. I don't know how he did it. And they'd go running around, I swear to God, in the valleys together. So he grew up like that. Then I had to move back to New York for a couple of years, and I lived on Long Island. That's not to be confused with Long Island. I lived on Long Island. And there are long guys there. And the dog was chained in the front of the house, and I had to go off to work. I came home, there was a chain and no dog. And my worst fear is probably that some animals took the bandit and used it in some terrible torture. That's the worst thing. I don't even want to think about it. But this dog was smart and tough. He once fought a Rottweiler in the neighborhood and scared the Rottweiler. The Rottweiler didn't run away, but the Rottweiler backed down. I don't know how he did it. He did. So the dogs are geniuses. They're apparently the collies are the smartest of the breeds, or poodles, I don't know. But there's a new study out of Germany that has found that a border collie named Rico now understands more than 200 words and can learn new ones as quickly as many children. And so they say that's good news for those of us who talk to our dogs. Now, if this dog has a vocabulary of 200 words, that means he has a larger vocabulary than Tony Soprano and all of the rap artists in America put together. They seem to be stuck on one letter, words that begin with an F. I don't know why, but they make a lot of money at it. But Rico understands more than 200 words, and that's interesting. So the researchers have proven that people who talk to their dogs are cutting-edge communicators, not just a bunch of eccentrics. Now, the researchers found that Rico knows the names of dozens of play toys and can find the one called for by his owner. And this dog has a vocabulary size about the same as apes, dolphins, and parrots trained to understand words. But as I say, his vocabulary at 200 words is definitely larger than those of all of the Goombas on The Sopranos when you add it up. But it's a very popular show, and people make millions of dollars an episode for speaking as few words as possible. So it just shows you that the more words you know doesn't mean that you make more money. In fact, in America today, the less words you know, you make more money. In fact, those who know fewer words make more money. That goes for politicians who speak in sound bites, and that goes for actors who speak in approximately 50 to 60 words maximum. And that, of course, goes for rap artists who have a vocabulary of about 40 words, and The Sopranos who have a vocabulary of about 73 words. So the old adage of, you know, literacy may be gone with the wind. Maybe it's an endangered thing to do is teach your children a lot of words. Maybe you shouldn't teach your children a lot of words. Have them watch Howard Stern's show and to abuse the mentally ill. They'll get very far in the world that they're growing up in. The researchers put several known toys in a room, along with one that Rico the dog had not seen before. From a different room, Rico the dog's owner asked him to fetch a toy, using a name for the toy the dog had never heard. The border collie was able to go into the room with the toys and 7 times out of 10 bring back the one he had not seen before. The dog seemingly understood that because he knew the names of all the other toys. He figured the new one must be the one with the unfamiliar name. So it just shows you, 200 words now, and that means that if you're talking to your dog, you really do have man's best friend. Man's best friend.
Savage.
I think I'm going to devote myself entirely to animals and animal rights. There's nothing else out there. The rest doesn't make sense to me. They're so innocent. Yes, I eat meat. Please leave me alone, but I love my dog. What do you want from me? It's hypocritical, I recognize. Somehow when I see an elephant, I don't want to eat elephant meat. When I see a whale, I think it should be protected. I mean, there are certain species that are different than others with regard to their sensibilities. I mean, cosmically, a mosquito is the same as an elephant. It's DNA, I understand that, with a certain, you know, combination. In a sense, there's no difference between a mosquito and you if you're a Democrat. But that's because you're a Democrat and you're an atheist. I'm not an atheist. I think there's a difference between myself and a mosquito personally. But the point I'm making is, yes, all animals are theoretically DNA and their own specific type of DNA, but there are differences in terms of, you say, well, is it just the size? Why do we feel sympathy when an elephant goes down? Why do we want to protect the Sumatran tiger that is being decimated by the vermin in Sumatra who are killing them for some reputed masculine enhancing powers in China with the lunatics in China who don't have enough with Levitra? Why don't you just give everyone in China Valium and stop it? I mean, what is it called? What's the one, the male enhancement drug? I don't even know the name of it. Isn't it with a V, Viagra, right? I said Valium is the opposite, shows you. Instead of letting them kill tigers to take out their glands to give to the losers in China who can't, you know, just give everyone free Viagra and Levitra over there. I mean, I'd contribute to a fund. Free Levitra for everyone in China who needs it. I'll put up a certain amount of money so they stop killing tigers. Wouldn't you? Why should we inherently protect the Sumatran tiger when we have millions of dogs and cats killed around the world? Why do we protect the elephant and the mountain gorilla when we have millions of cats and dogs that look at you with the little sad eyes that we euthanize every day of the week somewhere on Earth? Why, oh, why, oh, why? I mean, and there is a difference, I guess, between a whale and the catfish, right? But the catfish wants to live as much as the whale does. Why is it when I see a big marlin on the end of a hook, I'm praying to God the line snaps? Why? When I don't care if someone catches a catfish. Tell me why. Explain it to me. It's a philosophically intriguing question to me. All right. Now, Fat Al's tuna, that's a recipe. When I was a boy working as a busboy in the Shanks Paramount Hotel, I saw how tuna was really made. Fat Al was a 350-pounder. Now, when he made tuna in a tureen, he didn't use a mixed mass. They used his hairy forearm. He had his cigarette dangling from the right side of his mouth, and the kitchen was banging and bustling, and the people were out there eating a ninth meal of the afternoon. And he was mixing a tuna. He would throw the cans of tuna in. They'd throw in vats of mayonnaise. And the guy stirred it with his arm. He rolled up his undershirt. You see, you got to visualize this. Fat Al would lean over that tureen with the arm, the big, giant Italian arm, full of hair. And his arm was mayonnaise thick up to his armpit. And he's got the arm moving around. And he said, "You see, kid, you keep moving it till you get a nice creamy consistency." Meanwhile, the ash is falling off his cigarette. I guess that helped the taste of the tuna because the people never complained. They loved it. Now, that's a tuna. There is a proper tuna with a little sweat and arm hair. Now, that is a good tuna fish recipe. Other than that, I don't want to talk about recipes. Here's a story on the two faces of England that caught my eye. It said, Englishmen quade up to denounce their country as being sick and depraved in an article in Der Spiegel. According to the German magazine, our island story is now filled with brawling drunks, overflowing prisons, truancy, late trains and racists, and our only heroes are philandering footballers. We have become a nation ill at ease with ourselves. It sounds like America. Now filled with brawling drunks, overflowing prisons, truancy, late trains and racists. And the only thing missing from that list are phony liberals. Our only heroes are philandering footballers, so we could substitute philandering basketball players. We become a nation ill at ease with ourselves. Yet in the same week, a new guidebook paints Britain as an idyllic country where everything stops for afternoon tea, complete with cucumber sandwiches and crumpets, delicious fruitcakes and jam sponges. Everyone wears tweed in the country, and the trains generally run on time. The only problem with the English is they can't speak the language properly. That's the one problem with them. They never, like, kept up with the times. They speak a kind of a brittle, older language that's not really, doesn't really resemble the English that I know. And it doesn't work for them anymore. That's why they're shriveling as a nation. Can you name one British talk show host that sells in the world? No. People don't like that British accent was hot in the 60s. Everyone hired, like, a chick who had a British accent because all the Jewish guys in the garment center got hot for that. You know what I mean? "Yes, Mr. Katz is not here." They always hired him in the garment center. That's who they hired. But that's over with. No one won. Now they want, like a Puerto Rican woman or Mexican. That's like, in a certain way, it's reverse de classe. If you got someone who speaks that kind of parochial English, it's more appealing in a certain way, very in your face. No one wants that English thing. That's over. In the 60s, yes. Right through the late 50s, early 60s, the Twiggy, the Beatles, the Aston Martin, the whole thing was very cool. But then the English thing died. With the breakdown of the nation with immigration, with the breakdown of because of the asylum and the liberalism and the whole thing, England is no more. I mean, they're just not what they were. So it's fine if you like it. I'm not knocking it. But the English accent does not play the same way that I enjoy listening to it. It's kind of archaic and cute in its own way. But it's not used in the same... Remember, how many people do you call up today in business and get that English girl accent? No one. No one anymore. I'm not putting it down. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that no one is into the English accent thing as cool. In fact, it has a reverse effect on people. I never forget when I was in graduate school, I had a professor I really admired a lot. Now, he was an American PhD, a really fine chemist. He was the chairman of the pharmacology department, and I was doing graduate studies under him, and I love this guy. He had come from a major American pharmaceutical firm and retired to teach pharmacology, and I really admire this guy, okay? Now, he spoke, he's not a New Yorker, but he spoke a regular Midwestern New York accent. I'll never forget, I was thinking of this just the other day while shaving. An English professor had come to meet him and talk about something, and the Englishman walked in and said something like, "Daryl Devonshire here," and he said, "I'm Frank. How are you?" In other words, he didn't get intimidated by the Derby Devonshire thing, nor did Derby Devonshire necessarily do it to rank him out. He may have. But the point I'm making is that by answering in his own accent, he was he, and the other guy was he. You know what I'm saying? He was he. So learn to be who you are. Don't try to change yourself. Believe me, I could speak corporatese as good as the next guy. I was a corporate consultant for many years. And I found out as time went on, I don't have to sound like I'm from the Midwest in order for people to understand me. They're listening to my ideas, and they will listen to the New York accent just as well. As a matter of fact, it's kind of engaging for many Americans because it is so unusual for them to hear an authentic New York accent in an age where everybody's been corporatized into some sanitized, homogenized, Martinized American.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Ding-a-ding-ding-dong-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. Boom-ba-da, ba-do-ba-do-ba-day. Whoa, life could be a dream. If I could take you up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart.
So Bill Gates is arguing for death panels. Listen to Bill Gates talking about health care. I caught it on C-SPAN. I may be the only one in America. I was stunned. Listen to clip 02.
You know, is spending $1 million on that last 3 months of life for that patient, would it be better not to lay off those 10 teachers and to make that trade-off in medical costs? But that's called the death panel, and you're not supposed to have that discussion.
You see, so he's now toying with the very death panels that we warned you Obama was trying to introduce with Obamacare. And, of course, the vermin in the media, the propagandists in the Reichstag, the propagandists in the Reichstag said, no, there are no death panels. Now we find out there actually are death panels. So they're using the greatest salesman of all time, Bill Gates, with his ecology look, to peddle the death panel idea. Now he then attacks specialists in medicine. Listen to clip 3.
One statistic that jumps out is we have 3 times as many specialists as we have general practitioners. And no one else's system has anything like that. That is unique to the United States, and it's because it's a rigged market. That is,
now, let's stop for a minute. Now, I want to ask you something. Do you actually think that Bill Gates would go to a general practitioner if he had something serious wrong with himself? You know, he'd go to a so-called specialist, the best in the land, wouldn't he? And it wouldn't be found in Cuba. It'd be found somewhere, or perhaps, maybe in Seattle. I doubt it. Perhaps UCLA Med Center, somewhere in New York. But he certainly wouldn't go to Cuba for his medical care, and you know he'd seek out a so-called specialist. But here's Bill Gates now, the salesman, not only arguing in a subtle way for death panels, but against specialists in medicine, saying they should all be GPs. And perhaps next he will argue that we shouldn't have any Americans going to medical school anymore because they're spoiled and they speak English that's too good. So we should bring more people in from Pakistan to be doctors. This is unbelievable to me. Now listen to clip five. This is the best of them all in clip five.
In Medicare, if you can get your asthmatics to have acute episodes, you get rich. And if you teach them how to take their medicine and how to do the right things, you go to the poorhouse.
So here is Bill Gates now attacking doctors, calling them corrupt, saying that they're all corrupt. And it's unbelievable to me how he suddenly threw himself into this discussion. I wish old Bill Gates had shown his true colors back when Obamacare was being shoved down our throats by Nancy Pelosi. But Nancy Pelosi, with the hammer, you know, she just hammered it down our throats. And now Bill Gates suddenly is telling us that there are death panels, we don't need specialists, et cetera, and so on. Now, having said that, if you ask me, do we need revisions in the healthcare model in America? Yes, we do. I have a much simpler solution that wouldn't upset too many people, that would get rid of the grifters. And that's called a $15 to $25 copayment for every single doctor visit. I don't care if you're a bum in the street. You have to pay a copayment. I don't care if you have to go collect cans or you have to pick up whiskey bottles and turn them in for 5 cents a piece. You're going to pay a copayment every time you get fallen down in the street. We're not picking you up anymore unless you pay for it. We can't afford it anymore. Treat yourself better and you won't be laying in the gutter. Or stop grifting the system by visiting five specialists a week for nothing. Of course you're going to have people who have nothing in their life to go and listen, have their troubles listened to by a doctor. They love nothing better than to march in with their folder and have a nice young man or young woman pay attention to them because no one else wants to listen to their complaints anymore. So they sit there, this hurts, I got a crank in my back, and how was it, and how did it touch? And how long did your mother live? And it hurts me in here. I touch me on the heel. That hurt. And over there, touch me here. Can you touch my ear? I need a trim. Give me the nails. I want the nails done, by the way. Can you do a pedicure? And then the next day, they go to another one. Now, Obama is so whacked out on this subject that he actually introduced that we are going to have to subsidize mental health care on top of it all. It's bad enough we have the cranks with the physical ailments, 90% of which are made up. Now the cranks are going to come in with mental disorders that we're going to have to pay for. Who's going to pay for this? You're going to pay for it? It's impossible. Let's use a liberal word. It's unsustainable. Does that work for you? Let's use a liberal word. It's unsustainable. Everything Obama has created before he went off on vacation is unsustainable. Virtually everything he's touched is unsustainable. Everything, including Michelle's trip to Spain at $75,000 a day. Unsustainable. Only there's no song called Unsustainable You. Now, why does Bill Gates suddenly become the chief salesman for socialized medicine? That's the interesting question. Why did they enlist Bill Gates with the sweater and the oh-be-gosh, you know, college boy look? I have nothing against Bill Gates. You know, he did a great thing, created a great business. I admire entrepreneurs who succeed honestly. There's something to admire in every single success story in America, so long as it's honest. Don't get me wrong. But why is he now dipping his beak into this healthcare thing so late into the game? What's this all about? This is the interesting question. Why is Gates now peddling Obamacare with death panels? The answer is simple. The man's corporation employs what, hundreds of thousands? I don't even know how many people are employed by Microsoft. Whatever the number is, if he could introduce death panels and they could cut out care for the last 3 months of a person's life, think of the millions that he could save, that he can give away and look even bigger. Okay, that's number one. And number two, there is a somewhat rational argument to be made for less medical care at all levels, incidentally. Never mind just in the last 3 months of life. I have limited medical care for myself and my family to almost the last emergencies. We go only in emergency. That's the way medicine should be looked upon. It should not be called the first crank, the first little pain. The propagandists in the propaganda ministry known as the media told you you were a right-wing maniac for even suggesting there were death panels. But again, there are death panels, and now we're hearing there are death panels. Now, I include this in my book, Trickle Up Poverty. I'm mentioning it, whether you like it or not. It's probably going to be the biggest book of 2010. It's available, frankly, not won't be available till October 5th, but it's on Amazon for pre-orders. And as I say, I mentioned death panels. I explained it. I found it in there. But the vermin in the media, the propagandists, the Leni Riefenstahls, the Goebbels of today, who work for the Stalin of today, laughed at us and said we were all right-wing nuts for warning you about death panels. But as sure as we're sitting here, they're in Obamacare. That's why Bill Gates is now peddling it, because he has so many employees it would cut his expenses and give him greater profits. And since his mind is always on the bottom line, no matter what he says, he knows that by cutting out some late-term care, his bottom line will be better. Now, you could argue as to whether or not that's rational. But don't lie about it. Don't say there weren't death panels in Obamacare when we know there are death panels in Obamacare. We're the only ones in the media who warned you about it. Not those who are impeded mentally on the television stations like MSNBC and CNN. And again, here we are. Last night, I live in a small town part-time, so I see six fire trucks. The show is over. I come home. Six fire trucks, police cars, police action, cops running back and forth, the streets closed off. I'm looking. I don't know what's going on. The firemen are running. The police are running. So I got the dog. I walked down the street with Teddy, and I inquire what happened. Apparently, it was a kitchen fire that my mother would have put out with a bottle of seltzer. Six fire trucks, six police cars, the street closed off. So I jokingly said to my neighbors, they came from four different surrounding towns. I'm not kidding you. A kitchen fire that you could have put out with a glass of water. Two punks live in there with their mother, apparently. They could have doused it out with a bottle of soda. Four trucks or six trucks and sirens and the street closed down, three departments. They all came running because they can write it on the books that they went to put out a fire. So I said to the neighbor, I guess they've justified their pensions here. So they laughed. You think people don't know what's going on? I mean, you think people are stupid? This is not to denigrate the individual fireman or the individual cop. But we all know that the pensions are unsupportable. We all understand that. And we all understand that civil service jobs today are golden. They're the golden jobs of America today.
Savage.
I decided there's nothing there that I like. Nothing. Zero. The air stinks. The people are degenerated. It's a disgusting place on earth. I've never seen such debauchery or sickness in my life as Hollywood, now that I think about it. For a while I enjoyed it, I got to admit it. I live a kind of reclusive life in Northern California, and I've gone, a couple of times a year down to L.A., and you get caught up in the fun of it or the excitement from on the surface. But I'm not really a surface kind of guy anymore. When I was 18 to like 30, doesn't mean I don't have a good time once in a while, but that scene is so debilitating. I don't know how anybody can live there on a regular basis. When I looked down from my window in the Hollywood Hills and I saw people in their 20s or early 30s coming home from a party at 5:30 in the morning, stumbling out of their Maserati, unable to drive their car up the driveway, getting out with two trashy, white trash, verminous chicks, stumbling into the house. I said, this is an inheritance case that will ruin the father's inheritance within a few years. He'll burn it up, this one. I look out the window at 3:30. The cars were still going up the hill, the taxis, the limos, honking horns, the drunk. The next day I walk up the hill, I see empty beer cups, liquor bottles. I think I saw a dirty syringe in the gutter next to the garage. I said, what a country of lowlife, degenerate scum, I said to myself. How can you glorify this? How can you enjoy any of this? And so I've come back to being me, which is a curmudgeon. And I'm like Barney the Undertaker here. I've had my share. I mean, how much can you? You can't have... you can't have your foot in both worlds. It's impossible. Either you're in one world or the other, I think. Now, of course, there's no such thing as a pure human being. I understand that. And I don't try to be a monk or anything like that, but my God, I think we're a nation of drunks. The more I look around, whether it be at Universal Studios or at Disneyland, wherever you look, everyone's drunk. If they're not drunk, they're on Prozac. I think I'll tell you about my car, the sadist. We've gone from Herbie the Love Bug to Herman the Sadmobile in a very few generations here. I get it back from the dealer, and the LED comes on and says that I have a flat tire. So I stop the car. I get out of the car. I'm on the roadside, and I'm sweating. I just got showered, ready to go to the radio station. I go around. There's no flat tire. I go back in. You can't turn off the thing. It's an exclamation point. It says, you have a flat tire. Now, I just came back from the dealer. Why? Because I had to tow it out of the driveway, like, I don't know when, because the key wouldn't go into the slot. It kept coming out saying, ha, ha, ha. I'd push in the electronic key, and it would come out. No matter what I did, I push it in, it pushed out. I push it in, it pushes out. I thought I heard, like, a mocking laugh in the background going, ha, 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 but I couldn't be imagining it. So the car dies in the driveway. I have to call a dealer. They tow it away. This is a brand-new expensive car with a crazy, sadistic computer drive in the middle that nobody can work. Nobody. For a year, I couldn't get the radio to work. It's all crack music on FM. They get a driver who sends it over. They know how to work it. Every station is, I'm going to drop my pants, and I'm going to hit the cup, I'm going to make the girl, and hit the back. I'm going to do it. Every station that I turn on is another variance of illiteracy and anti-American degeneracy. So I try to put it on to AM manual. I almost get a station I could listen to. Bingo, it's right back down. I'm going to bang the thing, and I'm going to break your head. I couldn't believe it, so I turn it off, so I have no radio in the car. You turn the heater on, the seat moves. You turn the windshield wipers on, you get sprayed in the eye if the window is open. Gorgeous car, great road car. The best road car I ever owned. The problem is you can't work the radio, you can't work the heater, you can't work the seat. And now my car, the sadist, tells me that I have a flat tire when I don't. The navigation system, you could turn the car over trying to see it. You need a magnifying glass while you're driving. You ever try to program a nav system in a car while you're moving? Any one of them is no good. But this is the worst of any car I ever owned. Bar none, I've never seen anything like it. And they have another sadistic element to this navigation system that I must tell you about. It's a trick. Herman the Sadmobile has a little trick built into the computer chip. Let's say you put the navigation system. First it says, and it says you have to say, I accept, and then you hit the thing. Then something goes on. So then you pull the knob while you're driving and hope you don't run a chicken over. And it goes on to the navigation system if you pull it a certain way and radio the other way. So now I have the map comes up. Now the trick comes up. It gives you six choices when the map comes up. If you hit the wrong choice, a voice starts talking to you that you cannot turn off. It says, go two blocks and turn left. Now, you don't want the instructions, but they keep giving it to you. And there's no way to turn it off unless you stop the car and turn it off. Now, that's if you hit the wrong knob. So I've learned how to bypass that. It's like the whole thing is like an obstacle course. Wonderful car. Gorgeous. Best driving car I ever had. I can't wait till the lease is up so I can give it back. And I may buy, like, the simplest, most basic, non-technical car if they can still make them. I don't think they can make a car anymore. Now it tells me I have a flat tire. I'm afraid of getting the car. It's liable to give the car flat tires. I left it in the garage at the radio station because it had no flat tires, but it was still reading flat tire, flat tire, flat tire. So I called the dealer. I said to him, it says I have a flat tire. He says, oh, that's because it reads, if it goes down to 5 pounds below the normal inflation on any tire, it says you have a flat tire. I said, but you just serviced it. Shouldn't they put air in the tire? Now I'm afraid I'll go in the garage and Herman the Sadmobile will have given me an automatic flat tire. For all I know, they designed it so that if you don't service a flat tire, they'll give you one just to make sure the computer feels good.
A four-speed dual quad positive traction 409.
What can I tell you? That's the world I live in. I feel like the political cowardice that I'm facing every day is like Herman the Sadmobile. It makes no sense. It's like a machine out of control.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Most normal people are in Spain. They're somewhere. Everybody's somewhere. I don't know. Everyone's on vacation but me. I'm the only one who won't go on vacation. I refuse. Now, don't assume I'm just some grumpy old guy. I mean, I have been in many, many places, some exotic, some pedestrian. I don't get the charge out of travel that most people do, yet I understand the need for travel, to be the idea of going somewhere, you know, to feel like you've, in, you know, left your regular day behind. But, you know, when you're in the media and you live on the edge, as we do, if you're doing the right thing here, traveling doesn't do the same thing that it used to do. I mean, you need it if you have a kind of humdrum life. I don't understand it as much. Maybe when I was young, exotic. Well, what's there? But even the world, 30 years ago, there were differences. You go to Spain, you'd see women walking around in black. Now you go there, you see women looking like the same that you see here. Let's be specific. The same clothing everywhere. It's one homogenous blur, the entire world. The one homogenous Western blob has descended upon the world from here to Manchuria. The same thing, everyone wanting to look like a child at Disneyland. So what's the excitement? You trek to Mongolia and see Mongolians wearing the same, the crack outfits that they wear in the streets of a ghetto here, with the same, you know, haircuts. So who needs it? I'd rather stay here, whatever. So yesterday I got bored because of that, and I realized that, you know, happiness is within. The kingdom of God is within. It's not out there. I don't have to go to Jerusalem to find God, so to speak. So, you know, it was written years ago, the kingdom of God is within, and the kingdom of happiness is within you also. So I said, you know, you got to make yourself interested in life. Life isn't going to come to you and make you interested, so stop it already. You've been there and you've done this. You've gone in circles. Stop with the boredom talk. I had to whip myself into action. It's like one of those doldrum times, you know, where like I'm becalmed on the sea, the high sea of life in that sense. Because success is a stale finale. I got to admit it to you. I'm not boasting. Eugene O'Neill wrote that. And it's 100% true. The years I was struggling were more interesting in a way than these years. And I'm not begging fate to suddenly cast me down again. But the point I'm saying is success is a stale finale. There's no question about it. Eugene O'Neill wrote that success is a stale finale, as I just said. The struggle is the success. And when you cease to have a reason to struggle, believe me, nature hates a void. Nature abhors a vacuum, as it's been said, and she'll fill that vacuum with something for you to struggle with, whether it be a nice cancer maybe, a little brain tumor, whatever. Go ahead, keep complaining, and you'll have a nice little reward, I say to myself, because I am, man, I look up. I mean, I know that he's up there looking down, and I know you start asking for too much, you know what you get, a good kick in the behind. So I said to myself, all right, stop it already. You love art. So I go to Bonham's Auction Gallery. Lucky for me, it was a gloomy Sunday in San Francisco, and the Bonhams Auction Gallery is coming up with an auction of Western paintings. Now, I don't mean European art. I mean fine paintings of the West, whether it be Indians or cowboy, just really good, really high-end. I'm not talking Dreck art. We're not talking John Nagy. I look online, and I go through maybe 150 paintings, and I found about six that really look good. So, okay, we pack the whole group into the car, dogs and all. We trek over to the homeless encampment down south of Market, near South Van Ness. We pass the shopping cart folks, and we go into the auction gallery. It was a very nice experience. I felt transformed back to my early years of enjoying art and being in my father's antique store and going to museums. And I looked at the paintings very, very closely. They looked better than they did in the catalog, the online catalog, incidentally. Five of the six did. There was one that struck me as particularly amazing, and it showed a group of, I forget which Indian tribe, you'll have to forgive me, I don't remember which one. It shows them making camp after the first snowfall, where the commentary about it is, it's the first snowfall in the West, you know, some Western range, and this tribe of amazing Native Americans are going out on a hunt after the first snowfall, and they say that the hunt will be very easy because the animals' tracks will be highly visible in that first snowfall. And I think it's called a smokeless fire. These people were such geniuses, the Native Americans, that they could build a fire in the snow with a little lean-to, a smokeless fire. And I'm the kind of guy where I could stare at a painting and get so sucked into it that I'm in there with them, and I'm saying, my God, 20,000 years of living on this continent, and these people not only could live off the land, they had a civilization to go with it. They weren't just simply primitives, you know, grunting. They had a real civilization. A language of their own, a culture of their own, rituals of their own, astoundingly beautiful. But this isn't the first time I've come to that. I wrote a book in 1972 called Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, Native American Remedies, etc. So I've long been an admirer of Native American culture, to be frank with you. This isn't the first. But it's a great painting. It brings you back to the reality of what we're living in, how lucky we really are, how lazy we all really are, and how incapable we really are of living on our own, unless you're the rare guy who knows how to hunt and trap and things of that nature. And I don't know how many of them are left. Don't call me if you are. I appreciate that, you know, that many of you do know how to do it. So here we are, and that's the end of that. And here we are, and I had a bad Chinese meal, overate, almost had the stomach. Oh, that's what I was going to tell you. So I'm in the place, looking at the paintings. Now I wanted to tell you the point of the story. So there's a showcase on the way out with, like, memorabilia, like letters, you know, from the artists. And one of the – I had to tell the audience this. I knew it. I look in the showcase, and it's a letter from 1924 from the artist, one of the famous Western artists, to the client who had purchased a painting for, I don't know, $75 at the time. And the artist writes a beautiful letter in beautiful handwriting, unlike today where they have hieroglyphics, they text, they can't even write their name. He writes a gorgeous letter in blue ink to the buyer. And he said, enclosed is the bill, and I wanted to make this as beautiful as the painting. And so herewith is the enclosed. And he did a painting on the letter, on the bill, to the buyer. So I'm staring at this saying, why, my God, what a world this was of civility. And there were a group of gay men in the place, and we had a nice conversation. They loved my dog, and there was a different kind of group than you see the rabble here in San Francisco. This is the type of guys I grew up with in New York, much more civilized. Gay or straight didn't matter. You know, they talked to us because they loved the dog, and they said he looks like a little lion. You know, there was it was a different world, the kind I grew up in, as opposed to the rabble out here who think that they're wild because they have green hair and a ring in their nose. These guys were very nice. I'm leaning over the case, and one of these gay guys comes over, men in their middle age, and looks in, and I said, my God, look at the letter. And he says, look at that letter. And I said, isn't it amazing the time, the 20s, that an artist would write, I wanted to make this as beautiful as the painting? And he paints another painting on the bill for the buyer. And he says, yes, yes, yes. And I said, yep, an age of dignity. And he said, that's exactly the word, isn't it? That's all a little snapshot of a day. Nothing profound. I burned my palm at Starbucks. I have that story to tell. I'm sitting here with it sprayed with some goo lucky I had in the closet here at the radio studio. Why in the hell do they make coffee so hot? Why is it when I go in for coffee, when I say, give me a small coffee, they always get a moron who says tall coffee, and I say, no, I said small coffee. And the moron will repeat again, since it's the Bay Area, filled with the biggest schmucks on earth, tall coffee. I said small coffee. And she looks at me with the clipped hair and the mean face, another moron they hired, and says, tall, small, it's all the same. I said, then why can't you call it what it is? Just give me a cup of coffee, will you please? She gives me the cup of coffee. I give her a tip because I tip fast food workers everywhere. Unfortunately for me, she left the top loose on it. I grabbed the cup, and it spilled on my left hand and burnt my palm. I didn't say anything. I'm not a liberal. I'm not going to sue. I know some of you are out-of-work lawyers who can't get a job with Obama, and you'd like my phone number. It's 1-800-449-8255. And I burnt my palm at Starbucks, and I'm not going to sue. But I do have an attorney on the line. Charlie from Tampa, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello, Michael. Yeah, I was listening to your show, and I understand that you have a severe third-degree burn possibly on your hand. And
I really do. I don't sue, but I'm pissed off because they make the coffee so hot. First of all, why didn't she put the lid on tight enough that when I picked it up to carry it across the floor, I spilled it on the palm of my hand. I burned my hand. It turned red. I mean, luckily, I came to the studio, and I have a spray, you know, with benzocaine in it, and the pain went away. But the hand's red. The palm is red. It'll smart for a few days.
You know, something like that, Michael's worth probably $1 million, maybe $500,000.
Ah, come on. You couldn't get a mill for a burn like this.
Well, you being a celebrity, maybe we can even up that a little bit. You're right. Maybe $4 or $5 million.
I'll tell you what. You know what? I'd put every dime into my Savage legal fund, and any money that's left over goes to a scholarship anyway.
Well, as a tort attorney, I don't even need a good reason to sue. I just got to think I can make some money, sir. You know, I mean, hey, it's what we do.
Well, I don't know how you can do it in good conscience, but I'm burned with guilt and a conscience. I was raised with a guilt complex, so I'm afraid to sue for nothing, you know.
Well, no, that's a good cause because you're severely, you know, could be handicapped for life now.
Come on.
Now BP's going to be sued because Charlie Crist opened the door for the homeowners to sue him now, so it's going to be endless. process. We are a litigious society.
They got cops in New York who are living on disability, 75% of a full salary, no taxes. Now they want to add mental stress so they can get even more money out of the taxpayer on a higher Social Security disability pension. It's shocking to me. You know and I know that this is going to come to an end, these gravy train contracts that the unions wrote. They're going to revise all of them. You know that.
Hey, I need to go out and make as much money as I can before our country falls.
Well, what are you putting your money into, though? Spanish pesos, or where are you investing it?
Oh, gold bullion.
You're in bullion? So when it all comes down, do you really think that we're going to trade, like, chips of bullion with each other for, like, white bread or something?
Well, the dollar's not going to be worth nothing, so I might as well have something that's I can hold on to. That and my gun.
Well, I hear they're thinking of changing the dollar bill and putting Obama on it, you know. It's going to be called the Obama rather than the dollar. And what's a dollar now will be worth a penny, but it'll be made of paper.
Oh, boy, we'll be buying yen before long, I guess.
Yeah, the yen. We'll be using yen in the streets. I have a yen for some yen. How much is a scold like this worth on the hand, on the palm?
Well, you know, if we talk to your, the insurance company, I'm sure we can settle something out of court, something that'll we can use for your legal funds.
Yeah, and then I would get on the air and I'd say, I didn't do it for the money. I did it so that the next poor person doesn't scold their hand, right? I do one of those speeches.
Well, next time they can check, teach these ninth grade dropouts how to put a lid on properly.
I couldn't believe it. She did it on purpose, too, because I dared say small instead of tall.
You know what? It's probably a hate crime because she knew who you were, Michael.
Well, she may have known. I saw the clipped hair and the mean face do a double clock. It's certainly possible.
Savage.
San Francisco, a cold wave we've had like this. I haven't seen anything like this in 40 years I've lived out here. It's like nuclear winter out here. Every day cold, cold, cold. So today we had a little sun. Finally, it looks a little bit like a bit of a summer. I haven't had one barbecue all summer, thank God. Only my schmuck neighbor. He'd have one in the rain. Just to spite me, he has a barbecue. I hope he doesn't get what the other neighbor got from barbecuing every day, a little stomach cancer. Who eats barbecued food every day of their life if they have an education beyond the first grade? These people are like Bronze Age people I live near in Marin County, California, like from the Bronze Age. The heaths. You know where the word heathen comes from? Barbecues and fireplaces. That's heathens. Every day, like burnt meat. Every day, a piece of burnt meat. He doesn't know that it's benzoapyrenes are going to give him a stomach cancer. Every day, a burnt, like a hunter-gatherer up there with the fire. He discovered fire. Fire, good. Burnt meat, very good. Not going to get cancer. No, it disturbs my neighbor. Make more fire. Fire, good. Go ahead. God sees the truth, but wait, see if I care. While I'm eating my tofu and beans, you eat your burnt meat. That's all. Don't call me about any of this. Nothing. Nothing. There's nothing I want to hear from you for. What are you going to say that I haven't said already? You know, what are you going to tell me what I know? Oh, God, look what I have to do for a living. I should have been a tailor. I could have sat in front of a treadle, not talked to anybody, just smoked Philip Morris and died at 47. Poor grandpa. Didn't have a chance. Came over, brought the family over one by one from Europe, ate his heart out in that tailor store on the Lower East Side, made suits for guys, nice suits, never got anywhere. Well, he owned his own store. He moved up. But he didn't have to talk to people like I do 3 hours a day, eating his heart out. I don't know. They all died so young. They had easier jobs than me. Why they dropped dead? I can't understand. It had to be the cigarettes. Don't say stress because my stress level is 10 times worse than theirs. So don't give me that stress garbage. Mine is 100 times worse. I should have been dead at 11 with my personality and my consciousness. Stress is Look, I studied this. The reason I went into nutrition and herbal medicine and looked for the searches all over the world and wrote all those books is because everyone died young in my family from heart attacks. And stress has almost nothing to do with coronary artery disease. Nothing. Zero. Don't believe a word of it. Life is stress by definition. Don't you understand that? And the more you struggle against stress, the more stressed out you are. Just accept that stress is life. And when you die, you have no stress. You know what I mean? Or if you move to Queens, one or the other. The point I'm making is stress has almost nothing to do with it. It's 90% Okay, let me tell you what I've discovered and what the medical literature says, and please don't call me on this. We all know it anyway, but let me just say it again. It's about one-third, one-third, one-third for any disease. One-third genetics, one-third environment, and one-third unknown. There's an unknown factor in disease. Don't you understand that yet? I learned this in graduate school when I was going for my PhD. I'll never forget my professor. He was a medical doctor and a PhD, and he said to me, you know, he says, I've opened up people at autopsy who've died of heart attacks whose arteries are perfectly clean. Now, that's a mind blower. No occlusion. You know, Lipitor and garlic and vitamin, nothing. The arteries were clean like a baby, and they dropped dead of a heart attack anyway. So there's a mystery to disease. You understand that there's a mysterious element to disease, as there is to so much else in life. There's a mystery to love. There's a mystery to life. Not everything is so cut and dried. So that's what I say. It's a third environment, which means smoking, exercise, nutrition, eating. A third genetics, where you have nothing. You can't do anything about it. And then a third mystery. Now, since you can't affect your genetics, you can't affect your unknowns, you work on the others. That's all. You don't eat like a pig. That's all. You eat like a sane person who wants to live, and you take mega doses of vitamin E and vitamin C and all of the other B vitamins that you need to know, and you got to learn all of that stuff. And then you pray a lot. You pray to God every night that you don't drop dead and leave your children without a father at a very early age. That's everyone in their 30s, 18 times a day, they're touching their chest. Oh, yeah, that's it. They're driving in the car. How many guys listening to this show are laughing right now? They're driving. They're in their 30s. I imagine this because I know it. It was like the 30s are the worst age in life. In the 20s, you're still like, I'm not going to live forever. Nothing's going to affect me. You're in the post-teenage years. Nothing. Then in the 30s, you get the first gray hairs. You get a little flab on your stomach. And every day, if you're married and have children, I mean, if not, well, you can get away with another 10 years. Every day in your 30s, you're driving. Oh, what's that twinge? Oh, and you're sure you're going to go off on the side of the road upside down. You're going to be an embarrassment to your family, dying a horrendous death from the big one. So many guys in their 30s. But let me tell you something. It gets easier as you get older. Because once you realize you are going to die, it doesn't matter. You realize it. You know, don't freak out over it. 40s are easier. Then the 50s are even easier yet. What do I know? Depends upon if you're lucky or not. You don't get sick. My mentors are guys like 80 who aren't, those have anything wrong with them. Still chasing women at 80. There are still men around like this? Astonishing. Okay, rock and roll. I want some rock and roll, real rock and roll. Give me some real rock and roll right now on the Savage Nation.
Heart and soul.
Being with you. I love talking with you. I love talk radio. I love the business that I'm in. I love the fact that we're the last link between you and the abyss. If it wasn't for talk radio and the internet, we would be in the abyss of communism. Because as sure as I'm sitting here, Obama and his cronies want to drag us into a world that the Chinese and the Russians left behind. As sure as I'm sitting here, that's where they want to go. These are far-left dangerous ideologues, but I'm not going to waste my time telling you what you already know, because you've heard it enough times to know it's true. So let's focus on the media that put this imposter in the White House. Newsweek, Time, you name it. They told you, they sold you a bill of goods. He was a genius. He was a messiah. He was the man who was going to save America and bring us together. He drove us apart. So here we are.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
and other stories of the new Pravda. As you well know, Pravda was the name of the official government newspaper under the ex-Soviet Union, and it means truth in Russian. And of course, it never told the truth, just as our media never tells the truth. And so that's why I dedicate this show to those of you from the ex-Soviet Union who know that we're being dragged, pushed, shoved, and tricked into the former Soviet Union style of life under Obama in particular, where he has surrounded himself by outright Marxists and haters of individual liberty. What do I mean by media lepers and other stories of the new Pravda? Well, Andrew Breitbart, the leader of the Internet revolution, the man who caused the all-powerful Obama White House to react to the Shirley Sherrod controversy, he appeared right here on the Savage Nation after an absence of 4 days, and he broke his media silence. He revealed on this program the true context of the Shirley Sherrod video, that the entire 43-minute video actually makes it look worse, not better. He revealed that he never attacked Shirley Sherrod, that he attacked the reaction of the NAACP to her remarks. Breitbart revealed that there could be a huge conflict of interest in Shirley Sherrod's hiring by the USDA, as she was recently given a settlement by the Department of Agriculture in the Pigford discrimination case. Breitbart defended himself from attacks by the midstream media, and he took direct questions from my callers. Not a single media outlet mentioned the interview. No website mentioned the interview. No radio show mentioned the interview. No cable news program mentioned Breitbart's statements. Now, we would expect that on the Savage Nation. But would you expect this from the so-called conservative media outlets that cover so many other stories? None of the so-called conservative media outlets covered his appearance either. The Limbaughs, the Hannitys, the O'Reillys, every last member of the self-proclaimed conservative media has placed themselves in the same camp as the Obama administration by refusing to mention this interview. It has become worse than the ex-Soviet Union. Why do I say worse? Because even Pravda would have noted the appearance of such a story, but would have mocked it and would have smeared it in print. But in America, the government media complex has a tighter seal of information than Stalin's regime ever did. It has made Andrew Breitbart and Michael Savage media lepers. Now, those who claim to be part of the conservative media rail against the Obama administration and its policies. But truthfully, when it comes right down to it, they're all part of the same club as CNN, MSNBC, USA Today, and the New York Times. They do not want the truth. They do not want a reaffirmation of our borders, language, and culture because they never mention it. They just want ratings and power. And that's why anyone who stands in the way of their path to power and glory is persona non grata. Anyone who speaks up just a little too forcefully for real conservative principles becomes an enemy. They don't want to end the corruption of the midstream media. You see, they want to become the midstream media. That's why Michael Savage's ban from Britain is ignored. That's why Andrew Breitbart is ignored. And the voices of the American people are ignored in favor of a relentless pursuit of power and glory. Media lepers and other stories of the new Pravda. You know, you are lied to on such a regular basis that you don't even understand what's going on. Illegal immigrants don't pay federal income taxes. And those who do pay federal income taxes, okay, get the money back when they file tax returns. Many illegals are also claiming tax credits, which result in payments from the U.S. Treasury. Criminal aliens account for over 29% of prisoners in Federal Bureau of Prisons facilities. Let's stop at that figure again. Criminal aliens account for over 29% of prisoners in Federal Bureau of Prisoners prison facilities, and they compose a higher share of all federal prison inmates. Now, let's pause at that. Do you have any idea what that costs? With an estimated cost of, what, $50,000, $60,000 a prisoner? Do you know how much this is costing us? Do you have any idea what the cost of illegal immigration is? A new study was done about a month ago. Illegals cost U.S. taxpayers about $113 billion a year at the federal, state, and local level. About $84 billion are absorbed by state and local governments. They're all bankrupt. So like locusts who have come across the border, and I'm sorry to put it in those terms, but there are costs. There are social costs. Do you understand there are social costs to social actions? Well, the social cost of turning the other way and turning the other cheek to illegal aliens coming into this country and breaking our laws are such that we have a broken society. So you have one state that says enough is enough. We can't take the gangs. We can't take the shooting of the police. They're killing our cops. They're overrunning the ranches. Arizona had to give up a good piece of a national park because of the drug dealing. And the federal government takes the side of the foreign invaders? Do you have any idea what you're seeing in front of your eyes? You know, on the way to the studio today, I got to tell you this before we go back to the politics at hand. I walk around San Francisco. I love to walk around the streets. It revitalizes me. In fact, everywhere on earth that I go, I don't care if it's the most beautiful beach or a mountain, I still like a city better. I guess it's born and bred into me. I'm a city boy in many ways. As much as I love the water, and I do, I still crave walking around and looking at people and observing human nature. So today before the show, I had lunch in my greasy Chinese restaurant. I got the chicken curry all over my shirt. I tried not to, but it's a drop always sneaks over the napkin. I don't know how. It's like a miracle. I could put rubber around it. A drop of the gravy you'll get on the shirt. Then I go for a walk, and I go down to Justin Herman Plaza, which is near the Ferry Building in this beautiful city. And normally there's one event or another. Usually nobody, people sitting around having lunch. It's a very beautiful open plaza. And if there's any event there at all, it's a left-wing stupidity event. Some stupid left-wing idiocy. Pushing some global idiocy of some kind or another. You know, do I have to reiterate what it might be? And today I hear singing. I couldn't make out what they were singing. They were wearing green undershirts. Young people were singing hymns. I thought it was hymns. Then I said, don't even get your hopes up. Yeah, I thought it was some green group. I didn't know what singing environment is good and do this. I'll go. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what to expect. So I walk closer and then I hear Lord and Jesus is the Lord. And I said, oh, my God, Christians singing in San Francisco, not being stoned by the vermin. I said, yeah, these are Christians. Christians singing in San Francisco about Jesus in San Francisco and not being thrown to the lions. And I saw people listening, and they were like coming from everywhere. They were being drawn to it. They're thirsting for it. The people in this city are thirsting. Thirsting for some truth and some beauty. They have nothing but pollution and insanity everywhere they turn. Pollution and insanity everywhere you turn. The media is worthless. The politicians are worthless. They don't know where to turn. So you see them coming into the plaza, and these children are singing hymns to God. So I went up to one of the people. She says, yes, we're a group from Louisiana. We're from Shreveport, the nicest people on earth. And they were singing, and I said, you haven't been sneered at? She said, no, not once. I said, well, who pays your way? Well, she said, each of the children pay their own way. I just shook their hands and said, God bless you, and walked away. But the point I'm making is, the only hope for this world, in my opinion, the absolute only hope for this world is would be the teachings of peace from all religions.
Savage.
Welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely place, such a lovely face.
Welcome to the Hotel California on the Savage Nation, the late great Golden State. Look how this state alone, you know, when I moved out here, I moved out here in 1974. It was a paradise. Everything was, I don't know, like a Technicolor Disney movie. It wasn't anything that was wrong about Northern California. I just loved it. And I moved there primarily because the schools were free. The public schools were great. And I never forget when my first child went off to the first grade in a little yellow school bus provided by the state. It was beautiful. I felt good in my heart. I was a poor, you know, graduate student trying to make a living. But I managed to scrape together every penny I saved in my life. I bought a little house. I had worked three jobs. Went to school. I just felt good about the future. I knew that both of my children, and I distinctly remembered, I said to myself, I'm not a rich man. I'm never going to be a rich man. Likely never a rich man. But that was okay. I never set out to be a rich man. We'll be able to go as far in school as they wish, based upon their own abilities and desires, because California had the fantastic educational system from education starting from the grade school. Then you had the Cal State system, which was one rung below the university system. And then I said there were graduate schools that were great here, medical schools, dental schools, law schools, engineering schools. Whatever they wanted to do would be up to them. I never felt I was going to lead them, push them every step of the way. It's not the way I wasn't raised that way. My father had a sink or swim philosophy, and although I was not quite as old worldish about it as he was, I really, in some ways, you know, it's up to them how far they want to go. The state was beautiful. The roads were paved. The streets were clean. And then slowly but surely, the liberal cancer started to infect the state. Governor Jerry Brown with his crazy ideas. And one after the other, they kept shoveling money at dead social programs. They started taxing business out of the state. They started to raise state income taxes, driving many productive citizens out of the state. They wouldn't crack down on the illegal aliens, even though people knew that they were bankrupting the schools and bankrupting the hospitals. And look where we are today. When you don't stop a cancer, the cancer spreads. It doesn't go away. Take a look where we've come today, where you have the administrators of the state and of the nation who cater to the cancer rather than to the healthy patient. What if you went to an oncologist and you said, "Doctor, I've been told that I have a cancer, but it can still be stopped. What are you going to do to stop the cancer?" And a doctor studies your illness and he says, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to feed the cancer. I'm not going to try to save the healthy cells. I'm going to feed the cancer and see if I can make the cancer worse." You'd say, well, the doctor is either insane or a criminal. In either case, he should have his medical license pulled. Your politicians are like oncologists who are treating not the cancer, but they're trying to make the cancer get bigger. Instead of saying the healthy cells know what they're doing and we're going to help them, we're going to stop the invasion of the cancer, they're taking the side of the cancer. It's the same in Arizona. It's the same in California. It's the same in Illinois. It's the same in New York. It's the same in Florida. But the politicians are all feeding the cancer, for example. You got it?
Yeah.
Oh, little girl of mine.
Everything's good. We live in a paradise. I mean, the truth is, America is a paradise. It's the greatest country on earth.
Yes, you appeal to me. I never said you.
Now, I want to tell you something. I've been an observant person from the time I was a child. I was born that way. Well, I don't know if you're born or whatever. I'm super observant. I have been ever since I've been a child. An ant would go by, I would observe it. So I became a biologist early on. Now I'm a commentator, a social commentator. So wherever I go, I observe. So today, I bicycle past the park, and then, you know, school is out, and I see the kids, the little kids playing with their parents, and it's nice to hear as I zip by, and I hear Spanish. Spanish to the children, Spanish to the parents. And the children are playing in Spanish. They're playing Ring Around the Rosie. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, siete, ocho, nueve, diez. I said, how nice. They won't learn a word of English. The parents won't speak to them in a word of English. And you say, well, why do they have to learn English? You got these white liberal pinkos who cater to them in the foreign language of Spanish, giving them the welfare check, giving them the license, bending over backwards to make sure that they're comfortable in a country they broke into. So why should they speak English? No, speak the English. I'm sick of it. I'm getting sick of it. And I am the son of an immigrant. Learn the damn language if you want to stay here is what I'd like to scream, but I don't say a word. I bicycle by. I've learned to keep my tongue, except on the radio. I rarely say a word off the air, I'll tell you right now. Then I go down to the mall and there's a farmer's market. There it was again. The poorest farmers imaginable, they're really not farmers a lot of them. They buy it wholesale and sell it at a farmer's market, which is a ripoff unto itself, by the way. They're basically in a black economy, a black market economy. You know, and I think there's something wrong with that. There's no taxes on those farmers markets. There's no sanitation on the farmers markets. And what they're doing is they're undercutting the groceries and the supermarkets. Well, I mean farmers market. How many of those people are really farmers? They're not farmers. They're buying them wholesale and selling them by and large at retail. And so, but that's not the point. There it was again. There were the old liberal women going from stand to stand taking the freebies. It got me so mad. Again, they would say, one stand after the other like little chipmunks, the freebies. I fume. So I said, shut your mouth, don't say anything. Just buy the fruit yourself and do the best you can. Every last one of them may as well have been wearing an Obama sticker on her forehead. One old liberal woman after another with the freebies. I swear to God, the same type that you would see marching with the Greens or marching with Code Pink was marching from stand to stand, stealing the fruit, basically, from the poor farmers, if you want to call them that, not buying a damn thing. They come there to eat for free, and it galls me. It galls me. I can't stand it. It makes me sick. I once said, you're enjoying stuff in your face there? Whoa, she got mad at me. She was a Brooklynite who moved out here. She goes stand to stand to stand. They eat for free, these people. You never saw anything like this. I didn't say anything. I go on and I observe. Then I pass the bakery. There's a mother giving a child two chocolate donuts at the thing in the morning. Two infants, 2 years old, they're stuffing donuts down the face. And the fat mother's saying, "Ooh, what a good donut." Again, I wanted to say, lady, do you know you're poisoning your children? You're making them incapable of functioning? Again, I don't say a word. I go by. The Savage Nation, broadcasting from San Francisco to the world. One man's opinion is what it is. One man's opinion, that's all. Just my opinion. I try to back it up with facts. You don't want to read the facts? I can't help you.
Savage.
Volare. Oh, oh. E cantare. Oh, oh.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Blu, dipinto di blu. E che dici di stare lassù? E volavo, volavo, venice con alte del sole.
Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Mentre molto pian piano sparivo lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonare soltanto per me.
Volare. Oh. Cantare.
Cantare.
Oh. Dipinto di blu, felice te stare lassù, e volavo, volavo,
felice più in alto del sole ed ancora più su,
mentre il mondo piano, piano spariva lontano laggiù, una musica dolce,
musica dolce che suona per me.
Volare, oh, cantare,
cantare.
Oh, oh, oh,
oh,
nel blu, dipinto del blu, felice,
felice
di stare lassù,
nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu,
gnocchi for you. All right, knock it off, Mario. Get back in the kitchen. Let's go to WTNT. TNT, what a station title that is, huh? What an acronym that is. Mike in Washington, D.C. on TNT. What's on your mind, Mike?
Michael, Michael, Don Calamari sends his best to you, my son.
Wait, who?
Don Calamari.
Don Calamari, you mean Scungili.
No, Scungili's on the West Coast. Calamari's on the East Coast.
You're not really Italian. If you're confusing Calamari with Scungili, you're faking it.
I'm a real Italian, Mike.
All right, but you're mixing up. Calamari is calamari. It's a form of squid. Scungili is a form of a clam.
Of course.
Have you ever actually had Scungili?
Mike, I'm from downtown.
Oh, now you're giving me the whisper of job. I don't know who this is already. Thanks for the call, my friend. I don't like cutesy. I don't like people who talk to their children cutesy. It makes me squirm. You ever hear these parents talk to their children with, like, cute talk? That's why the child winds up a psycho. You know, I got to tell you a little trick about child rearing. In my opinion, one man's opinion, and I haven't done so bad. Speak to them as you would an adult. And they will grow up more intelligent. And they will be more competent younger. You ever listen to the people with the children? I love the ones who take them to a restaurant and give them a lesson in front of you to show how smart they are. How smart the child is with the pencils and the coloring book. You're spending $29 for a plate of spaghetti that costs 4 cents. And there they are next to you. The guy with the ponytail, he's 63, with a 30-year-old girl he met somewhere at a club. And right away, a year later, they have the 2 years later, they have the baby. And 4 years later, ready the coloring book and the crayons in the pasta palace. And they're all set up. They got the whole thing. They got the backpack. They got the diaper at your next table. And they got the coloring book and the crayons, which should be outlawed in restaurants. It's not ding-dong school. Not everything is a ding-dong school. There was a time, and I raised children. I wasn't allowed in certain restaurants with the children when they were young. I didn't like it. But I understood it. People didn't want to be disturbed by children. Now, if they get sued, if they say to the people, you know what, we'd rather you not change doo-doo at the table, right away they call ACLU or a lawyer like an ACLU, or like a smarter one than an ACLU lawyer, the brother who went into private practice with the same mentality. Marvin goes into the ACLU because he's stupid, and Barry goes into the private practice and sues, but they're the same mentality. Two heads of the same hydra. That's it, the coloring books in the restaurant. How do you spell Louisiana, Louise? Very good. And then the mother claps at the desk. Yeah, this is where you're sitting, you're having a romantic meal. $29.95 for the pasta al ripoffo. Antipasto consisting of a piece of old rotten cheese from Brooklyn that they couldn't sell to the Italians in New York because they know better. So they ship it to San Francisco. That's $9.95 for one little piece of mozzarella cheese and a tomato. They give it an Italian name, $9.95 with a tomato and one little piece of cheese that the Italians rejected on the wharf. Even the wharf rats rejected it, but they can sell it in San Francisco. And $29.95 for pasta al creato. I don't mind it, all right, but you're going in for the ambience. No one's there for the food. They're in for the ambience. But the coloring book is there right away. And the lessons you have to listen to. Do you ever hear these lessons at these tables? Does this go on in Louisiana or only in the major cities that you have to listen to these impossible parents? I never talk cute to the children. Okay, I'm a product of my upbringing. Harsh, Spartan-like. Don't be cute. I don't like cute. No jokes. Just get back to work. No matter what I did, I try to entertain my friend. All right, get back to work. Stop the entertainment. He knew I was trying to like wiggle out of work by entertaining him. All right, that's very good. Now get back to it. Now radio. On the way into work. I swear to God, if I was like driving in his car, I don't know how old I was. He didn't want the radio on. If I tried to put the radio on because it was horrible, sitting next to your father in a car on the way to work, it was going to be a horrible day in a disgusting market all day long, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go to begin with, but I didn't say anything. Okay, he needed me there. That was the way it was done. I didn't have any option anyway. It was like a little prison camp. But all right, so you sit in the right seat like a dummy, your hands folded on your lap, and nothing, not a word, mum. The whole ride, BQE, the Kosciuszko Bridge, the stink of the pork dying there, the Trun's Meat Market, where the eye goes out. You think that you ran over a skunk, but there are no skunks in Williamsburg. That packing plant in August was enough. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction. The Trun's Meat Packing Plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in the 50s was a WMD. That's why rents were low in those days. The floors were cockeyed with linoleum. That when a dog would urinate in the bedroom, it would run into the living room because the floors were old. But that's the way it was. No one complained. Today you got the same losers who can't live in Manhattan. They live there now. They discovered the charm of Williamsburg. Oh, I really love it over here. It's really great. You know, it's right near the overpass, and I like the factory area. Nobody ever wanted to live there. Even when it was in its heyday, nobody wanted to live there. But the point I'm making is a little different. So if you sit in the car, you're next to your father driving to work, and you know you can't say anything. There's nothing to say. He's grim. He's white. His hands are white-knuckled on the wheel because he's gone in again another horrible day to make a living. Nothing was fun. Nobody worked in those days for fun. This was an evolution of the Dr. Spock generation. Find what's fun and pursue it. Pursue what's fun. To my father, nothing was fun. It was grim. Horrible. It was like Grimm's fairy tales. Came over, work. Drop dead and move on. It's in the ground. In the ground. That's it. Next case. Next generation. There was no fun from another world. They didn't know what the word fun was. So he's driving to work. The hands are like white knuckles. And I'm sitting here. So my hand reaches. The left hand reaches for the radio dial. Like to punch a button in. No, no radio. So what do you mean no radio? I don't want music. Why? Never mind why. This is not... That's not entertainment. It's work. So, all right. So work has to be torture. I get it. All right. That's why I'm in the radio business. I was made for this. What I'm getting at is he didn't like cute. If he saw people, and I'm the same way, unfortunately, I become him in essence. This is how it is. All the years I resisted becoming him, I came, oh, a long time ago, I became my father. I admit it. There must be something to it. Worked for him. It's worked for me so far. But he didn't like cute. People who talk cute to the children. You know, the guy was 100% right. Let's say I'm talking generally, 9 out of the 10 couples did not talk to their children in because it was like embarrassing. Anyone who did that, the child either wound up in San Francisco wearing a pink set of tights at 19 expressing himself, or the girl wound up married to her sorority sister. 9 out of 10, they never wound up okay. None of them became anything. That's true because of the liberal upbringing. Liberalism not only is a mental disorder, but destroys children. You need to raise children the old-fashioned way. I don't say hurt them. I never got hit. He didn't hit me. Just verbal abuse. It worked better.
Savage.
Now we're going to talk about the man who sued IBM over adult chat room firing. A man who was fired by IBM for visiting an adult chat room at work is suing the company for $5 million, claiming he's an internet addict who deserved treatment and sympathy rather than dismissal. James Pakenza, 58, of Montgomery, whatever that is, says he visits chat rooms to treat traumatic stress incurred in 1969 when he saw his best friend killed during an army patrol in Vietnam. Now, I don't know how going to a chat room about sex helps that, but in papers filed in federal court in White Plains, New York, Pakenza said the stress caused him to become, quote, a sex addict. And with the development of the internet and internet addict, he's now claiming protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act. His lawyer, Michael Diedrich, said Pakenza never visited porno sites at work. He violated no written IBM rule and did not surf the internet any more or any differently than any other employee. He also says age discrimination contributed to IBM's actions. Pakenza, 55 at the time, had been with the company for 19 years and says he could have retired in a year. IBM has asked Judge Stephen Robinson for a summary judgment, saying its policy against surfing sexual websites is very clear. It also claims Pakenza was told he could lose his job after an incident 4 months earlier, which Pakenza denies. Company says plaintiff was discharged by IBM because he visited an internet chat room for a sexual experience during work after he had been previously warned. IBM also said sexual behavior disorders are specifically excluded from the ADA and denied any age discrimination. That's very interesting. That is very, very interesting to claim, traumatic stress disorder caused him to look at porn, and now he's an addict, a sex addict, and he should do what he wants? Come on, who's going to buy this? I don't believe it at all. What I believe here is going to happen is the lawyer is simply bargaining with IBM to try to get them to pay his pension and to withdraw the lawsuit. If I were IBM, I'd take him to court and I'd throw the bum out. It looks to me like if you work for a company, the law is very clear. You cannot use the company computer to go onto chat rooms if it says so in the manual. You can't visit sex sites if it says so in the manual. You don't own that computer. You can't do that at work. Now to come and retroactively say, "Oh, I'm an internet addict. I'm a sex addict. I deserve treatment and sympathy." Rubbish. No one's going to buy it. He said that he went on a chat talk to divert his attention from thoughts of Vietnam and death. You hear this rubbish? He says, "I was tempting myself to perhaps become involved in some titillating conversation." Come on. I don't buy this at all. Psychiatric treatment. I don't know what I want to do. I feel like I laid on the beach at Coney Island and I stay out of the sun because I had the skin cancer removed about 8 times already in the temple area from the early years, from in the sun when my mother thought getting color was good for me. Go in the sun, get color. I would come back like a lobster. Good, you look good.
In the summertime when the weather is hot, you can stretch right up and touch the sky. When the weather,
they were laying down a cancer in the skin. How did they know? They didn't mean anything by it. They didn't know. They didn't have a knowledge of it then. The same with the food. You know, the heavy food in the morning. Eggs and steak for dinner and meatloaf for lunch. Did they really know they were killing their son? They wouldn't have done it, I don't think. Do you think maybe they were doing it on purpose to get rid of the males? Sometimes I think that that generation of women was like as a female cult. They got married only to have a daughter, the son they could have done without, and the husband. Then the Viagra came along. Thank God many of them passed away before that. Could you imagine that? That the man loses the ability just at the right point when the woman doesn't really want him anymore to do that. Now all of a sudden, bing, they got Viagra going around. A guy could be any age. Suddenly he's like he's got a glint in his eye and he's stalking her all over the house and she don't want nothing to do with the guy. It's like a curse for a middle-aged woman. You know, you think every woman wants to do this? They don't. Most of them leave it behind them at a certain point. But in those days, the women gave it up after like the second child. They had sex twice, two children, that was it. God didn't want them to enjoy themselves because they never did enjoy it. Would you have enjoyed it either if your husband was like a furrier and weighed 350 pounds and looked like Gerald Nadler? You know, and that was set up. Most of you don't know who Gerald Nadler is. You got to leave him alone. He lost a lot of weight. Now, I'm not making any allegations at all, but, you know, I saw something shocking. In his heyday, Gerald Nadler, the heavyset kind, that's how we used to say fat in my day, heavyset. Or night, they used to say he's light on his feet. That meant for a fat guy, he didn't collapse altogether when he danced. But Gerald Nadler used to be really a hefty, heavy guy. Then all of a sudden, he went on some diet. Now he's like only doubly overweight. He's 150% of normal body weight for a man his size instead of 300%. There was a character in The Sopranos, remember? I forget his name. Is it Spatafori? The one who, no allegations at all, but he also lost weight, remember? This is the Savage Nation. To this day, if you drive from L.A. to Ventura, it's one of the most astounding things in the world to see the orange groves. They're still there. You know, that's where they shoot a lot of the old L.A. scenes. They drive you on that road, the Ventura Freeway, off the Ventura Freeway. And you see those orange groves. They're astounding. It's heartbreaking when they go down for a house. In Northern California, you live here, you see like plowed under. One housing development after the San Joaquin Valley. Millions of years of evolution. Ice age. Alluvial plain. Soil. The vegetable basket of the world. And then you see plowed under. When I see a cherry orchard or a pear orchard, I'm driving up on Highway 80 up to Lake Tahoe, and it's like I pray every time I take the ride it's not going to be like knocked down. Those rows of trees, you know, like generations of farmers. Nice people, raised children. One generation, two. Then the third generation doesn't want to raise the trees anymore. They want to cash in. You don't blame them. And it breaks their heart, but they take the $200 million for the land and they forget Grandpa. They have his ashes somewhere. They forgot where they put the ashes. They're off at Acapulco, wherever they went. Who knows? You know, Acapulco's coming back. I'm not out of it. It's coming back, making a comeback, Acapulco. It's like everything comes back. It's like Miami. For a long time, oh, you don't go to Miami. Now a lot of people like Miami. Cuban food, the beans, whatever. But, you know, you used to laugh when you say Acapulco because it was one of the first big cities. Today it's coming back. Maybe we'll do a tour, like a Savage tour of Acapulco. Maybe we can go cross the border into Mexico without our birth certificates or licenses. See what happens. What if we did a reverse thing as tourists, like 1,000 of us cross the border into Mexico? See what would the Mexicans give us, like water and condoms and stuff like they do coming in here? All the good Samaritans? Would they give us like a survival kit or would they shoot us? I mean, Vicente Fox is big on telling us we got to treat their illegal aliens. Why don't we try to sneak into Mexico and see what happens? See how they treat us. The electrons. Who wants to sneak into Mexico, man? You never get out. It's like traffic. Every time I go to Mexico, I feel like it's like traffic. You make one wrong move, you know you're going to be tortured somewhere. I don't go there for that reason. Well, Cancun is different. That's like an enclave. Nothing could ever go wrong there. You're protected. It's like Mulberry Street. Cancun is like the Mulberry Street of Mexico. I mean, when organized crime ran that area, you know you could go there at Christmas, leave your car unlocked because they were into crime. They were bad people, but they knew it was good for the restaurants and the general area. They had the old men in the doors, you know, always with the eyes, touching with the pinkies. And so the, nobody would rob in that neighborhood. They'd get killed. That's what Cancun is to Mexico. It's like the Mulberry Street of Mexico. It really is. I like to goof around a little bit because, after all, radio is primarily an entertainment medium, and you got to keep people interested. You know, people get distracted easily. They can listen to music, sports, this and that. So if they are doing me the privilege and the honor of listening to my show, I got to deliver on the goods. And let me tell you, at the end of the day, they got to know that they got value for the money of listening. That's what it comes down to. It may not cost anything to listen to a radio show, but I actually ask myself every day, you know, did I perform? Did I give them their money's worth? Otherwise, they don't listen. Why would you listen? Why would I listen to a show if I didn't get something out of it? Well, I have to just get a laugh. I can get a laugh anywhere, you know. Savage.